I've been here too long. Fetch the Bolt Cutters by Fiona Alba. And that does it for our show. If you'd like to sign up for our Daily Digest, our quarantine report, you can text the word Democracy Now, one word, to 66866. That's Democracy Now, one word, to 66866. You can also sign up on our website at democracynow.org, where all of our video and audio podcasts are and our transcripts of every show. Democracy Now! Is working with as few people on site as possible. The majority of our amazing team is working from home. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamarie Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Masood, Adriana Contreras, Maria Terracena. Special thanks to Julie Crosby and Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Tune in to KBOO on Wednesday, April 29th from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. for the live broadcast of the Urban League of Portland's Black Votes Matter 2020 Candidate Forum. This forum is an opportunity for Black voters and their allies to ask questions of the candidates running in the Portland mayoral race and the Multnomah County District Attorney's race. Again, that's the Urban League of Portland's Black Votes Matter 2020 Candidate Forum on Wednesday, April 29th from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Yeah.
There we are.
Oh, great.
Hey, good morning.
Hey, we're live streaming in with phones and distance and weirdness.
Yeah, our voices are going out through the thing to the people.
Thing, the magical thing.
Good morning, people. How are you?
Yeah, I hope you're all alive and well and not having a big lung problem or anything like that.
Yes, indeed. No big lung problems, please.
No, not even little lung problems.
All right, we have a number of things we want to get to on the show today. Those include the fact that the president's behavior and speech has been somewhat erratic. Somewhat, yes. And also, there's a number of U.S. states that are either beginning to reopen their economies in cautious ways or are planning to do so in the near future. We're going to talk about that also. But to start the show today, we have a departure from our normal protocol. In fact, I'm trying to remember the last time we did something like this.
I can't remember.
Yeah. It happened that Joe and I came across an opinion piece over the weekend written by a gentleman named Fintan O'Toole, who writes for the Irish Times. Mr. O'Toole is an accomplished opinion journalist, one of the most widely respected in the Western journalistic world, and he offers a perspective on how the United States is handling the COVID-19 outbreak, what that looks like from across the sea. And it is a telling and prescient and brilliantly written piece. So in a break with Abe and Joe's show tradition, we're going to hand things over now to my erstwhile co-host, Joe Uris, who's going to read to you this opinion piece from Fintan O'Toole in the Irish Times. Take it away, Joe.
Thank you very much. No, I hope people will be patient. I'm reading this in relatively small type, but I think I can handle it. This is Fintan O'Toole in the Irish Times. Over more than two centuries, the United States has stirred a wide range, of feelings in the rest of the world, love and hatred, fear and hope, envy and contempt, awe and anger. But there is one emotion that has never been directed toward the U.S. until now: pity. However bad things are for most other rich democracies, it's hard not to feel sorry for Americans. Most of them did not vote for Donald Trump in 2016, yet they are locked down with a malignant narcissist who, instead of protecting the people from COVID-19, has amplified its lethality. The country Trump promised to make great again has never in its history seemed so pitiful. Will American prestige ever recover from this shameful episode? The U.S. went into the coronavirus crisis with immense advantages, precious weeks of warning about what was coming, the world's best concentration of medical and scientific expertise, effectively limitless financial resources, a military complex with stunning logistical capability, and most of the world's leading technology corporations. Yet it managed to make itself the global epicenter of the pandemic. As the American writer George Packer put it in the current edition of The Atlantic, the United States reacted like Pakistan or Belarus, like a country with shoddy infrastructure and a dysfunctional government whose leaders were too corrupt or too stupid to head off mass suffering. It's one thing to be powerless in the face of a natural disaster, quite another to watch vast power being squandered in real time. Willfully, malevolently, vindictively, it is one thing for government to fail, as in one degree or another most governments did, quite another to watch a ruler and his supporters effectively spread a deadly virus. Trump and his party and Rupert Murdoch, Fox News, became vectors of pestilence. The grotesque spectacle of the president openly inciting people, some of them armed, to take to the streets to oppose the restrictions that save lives is the manifestation of a political death wish. What are supposed to be daily briefings on the crisis, demonstrative of national unity in the face of a shared challenge, have been used by Trump merely to sow confusion and division. They provide a recurring horror show in which all the neuroses that haunt the American subconscious dance naked on live TV. If the plague is a test, its ruling political nexus assured that the U.S. would fail at a terrible cost in human lives. In the process, the idea of the U.S. as the world's leading nation, an idea that has shaped the past century, has all but evaporated. Other than the Trump impersonator, Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, who is now looking to the U.S. as the exemplar of anything other than what's not to do, how many people in Dusseldorf or Dublin are wishing they lived in Detroit or Dallas? And it's hard to remember now, but in 2017, when Trump took office, the conventional wisdom in the U.S. was that the Republican Party and the broader framework of U.S. political institutions would prevent him from doing much damage. This was always a delusion. But the pandemic has exposed in the most savage way, abject surrender. Yes, abject surrender.
Do you want to take over?
I'll do the last paragraph because
okay.
It's a little heavy. And this will get worse before it gets better. Trump has at least 8 months more in power. In his inaugural address in 2017, he evoked American carnage and promised to make it stop. But now the real carnage has arrived. He is reveling in it. He is in his element. As things get worse, he will pump more hatred and falsehood, more death, wish, defiance of reason and decency into the groundwater of if the new administration succeeds him in 2021, it will have to clean up the toxic dump he's left behind. If he is reelected, toxicity will become the lifeblood of American politics. Either way, it will be a long time before the rest of the world can imagine America being great again. That's it.
Yeah, that's it. Whatever prestige, whatever moral authority, and I know both of those things are in hot debate among leftist circles in the U.S. and have been for many years, but to what extent those qualities prevailed in the wider world, they have evaporated under this presidency.
Well, actually, you know, it's important to understand something that I've been arguing for quite a while. There are many, many failings of American capitalism and the American system, beginning in its earliest history to today. But one of the more unique qualities was the opportunity for democracy and the notion that there could be clear moments of service to the human body politic. And right now, as you look at American politics, as you look at the behavior of this swine as president, it's clear that that's not necessarily going to be the case, and moreover, it's very unlikely to be the case if this guy sticks around.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, just consider the way the spectacle of the daily press briefings during the COVID-19 outbreak has played out. As Mr. O'Toole so succinctly put it, they have become, you know, parades for dysfunction, for malevolence, for vindictiveness, and all of Trump's petty personality traits have been there on full display. Now, consider how this played out. He started out doing this every day, you know, with the, at least ostensibly, with the objective that you would hope an administration would have in this situation, which is to communicate the latest and best knowledge to a populace that is terrified about contracting this deadly disease or spreading it to people who might die from it. And it devolved from there into sort of this personal passion play, to the point where ridicule of the president grew to the extent that he has decided maybe to stop doing these things.
But maybe he won't.
Right.
Maybe he
will. Think about that. Here's a president of the United States during a pandemic who has behaved so foolishly that he has decided in a petulant fit of pique to stop doing the daily briefings. I mean, it's absolutely astonishing to me.
Well, that's because he suggested people should eat bleach and shove lice into their bodies. I mean, you know, it was pretty weird.
Yeah, that's beyond weird. The President of the United States suggesting to people that ingesting or injecting household disinfectants is going to cure them of this plague.
Well,
I think that rises to...
It'll cure them of life.
Yeah, it will. I think that rises to manslaughter. Maybe, you know, reckless endangerment at the very least, but perhaps manslaughter. That's literally deadly advice.
Well, the saddest part of it is that some people in Iran of all places, and in the United States even, have actually tried this sort of thing and either died or nearly died.
Yeah. We've seen an uptick here in the United States of people taking household disinfectants into their bodies in one way or another. The president was actually confronted by it during one of these press briefings, or confronted about it, and he waved it off and said he doesn't understand that, can't explain it. Absolutely no connection between those events and his words. No responsibility at all is he taking for any of this. It is a deadly circus that he is playing out every day in front of the American people. Now, what I'm about to say may get me in some hot water with some of our listeners, but by and large, the people in the White House press corps in that room every day for the briefings have acquitted themselves pretty well. They have been asking the right questions in the right ways. They're not very often getting the sorts of answers that they need, but they have been applying the right sorts of pressure to the president, to the point that he got so upset that people were mocking him, you know, that he threatened to stop the whole parade and, of course, blame the media for it.
Well,
so this is one of those times when mainstream reporters are carrying their weight.
I sort of agree with you and sort of don't. I actually take a more radical position, and I've done a lot of reporting. I think when you get to the place where you're being told nonsense and lies, and you challenge it, and the president attacks you, and then starts attacking people who are perfectly reputable, perfectly responsible, very smart journalists, women, persons of color, and so on, he continues these attacks. I think it's time for the whole press corps, en masse, to stand up and walk out on it. They don't have to do it every time, but they should do it at least once.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. I suspect, I can't see the heads of these reporters, but I suspect that they, and I imagine their editorial departments, also feel that these daily briefings, however much they are co-opted by Trump himself, are the only venue in which rational voices, particularly Dr. Anthony Fauci, are able to speak directly to the American people. And that's pretty important right now. So the one could argue that the press briefings are worthwhile, if only because they give Fauci a chance to speak actual truth.
Well, I understand that, and I understand the dilemma these two doctors are in here, but it's really disconcerting to have them part of a package of distortion, lie, and evil.
Oh, yeah, it is absolutely disconcerting. And, you know, I think the tactic that you're recommending, that the press corps simply walk out,
They only have to do it once,
right. And at this point, the briefings have, with the exception of the input of Dr. Fauci, that have become completely devoid of any value. So, yeah, that would certainly certainly be entertaining to watch, if nothing else.
Well, here's the thing. When you say that, you're touching on something that's really weird about this whole presidency. For many people, it's simply an amusing circus. And a lot of his fans love the fact that he can, even being silly, be entertaining for them. And that's a very dangerous position, because they're not taking him, they no longer have to take him seriously while they're entertained by him and even while they vote for him.
I think that's partially right. I think what they value, what his supporters value from him, is, yes, his entertainment, but also the fact that he manages to own the libs, in the parlance of the right. They like the fact that he's able to say things that make left-wingers really upset, that make their heads explode, that send people into a rage on the internet or on the TV or whatnot. And if you think I'm exaggerating here, owning the libs is near the forefront of every policy objective from the standpoint of regular GOP voters. They love that stuff, and they love that Donald Trump does it. So they're entertained by him, yes, but they're entertained because of the way he mocks the other side.
So in other words, as low as he goes is what they like.
Yeah, they definitely like that. Whenever liberal and left-wing heads explode, they love that.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Well, I've been picking up the pieces of my head for a while here.
So that was Fintan O'Toole writing in the Irish Times. That that piece is behind a subscription wall, but it has managed to spread its way around. If you do a little searching about it, I'm sure you can find a version that did and made available.
Yeah, I dropped out about two paragraphs of it because it was really hard for me to read in this format, but... That's my fault. You out there should be able to find it and should read it.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So once again, this is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM. We are broadcasting once again in exile from our own homes. We're really pleased that you're able to join us this morning. We are grateful for the crew at KBOO that is keeping the station going during the pandemic.
Brave people, I think, really.
Yes, brave people and committed people, and we owe them our gratitude.
Yeah, and I want to tell people that you can call in. Can they call in? Yes, they can call in.
They can.
Okay.
We do have some people calling in right now. I can go ahead and patch them in for you.
Okay.
Yeah, let's hear a call. Sure. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are we there?
Hello. I'm good. Yes, sir. I'm a person who called in about... Hello?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, there's a bit of disconnection. Anyway, I listened to your opening this morning and really liked the article that you read. Your discussion concerning the liberals and how they have been attacked. They have been so discredited. If you listen especially to talk radio, the more conservative approaches, they... have done such a disservice to us so that we will not be able to regain credibility in many, many years. I was the person who called in a couple months ago and mentioned our country, it's time for us to look at coming apart, breaking apart in different regions. And I believe that coming back to that, that what's happening during this virus, it's showing us how disconnected we are with our regions. The West Coast, I'm very pleased to say, Oregon, Washington, California are taking this very seriously. They are using technology to get ahead of things, try to tamp this thing down. whereas the middle part of the country is kind of giving a middle finger to this virus and saying, look, if this is going to take us down, that's in their idea, it's God's will. We need to look at how progressives want to move this country forward. Conservatives want to take us back to a time where even now Noah's Ark is becoming reputable. So I think we need to take a serious look at time to break us up.
Well, I'm not going to respond to the breaking up the country thing, but I do want to say that we all of us need to make a distinction between legitimate conservatism, which does exist and can exist, and was exemplified by a variety of people, and some of them still writing columns attacking Trump, in fact, and the craziness that has developed around Trump. Trump has swept up the Republican Party into a package of weirdness that is almost unbelievable, and yet serves the interests of, I think, in the long run, a lot of interested people in the ruling class. But beyond that, makes people who feel apart or separate from the intellectual community, separate from the smarty pantsers, as it were, separate from people whose lifestyles are different than theirs. It gives them a sense of empowerment, and that empowerment is what is really scary in this. And there's only one example of that that comes immediately to my mind, and that's the Nazi era.
Correct.
Well, thank you very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Yeah, but I also want to say breaking the country apart is a nice theoretical model. Ain't going to happen.
The caller, I think, put his finger on something pretty important, and that's something I had mentioned just a few moments before, and that is this, he called it giving the middle finger to the left. And that's very much a part of what happens amongst the right, both on the part of voters and on the part of elected officials. Owning the libs, sticking it to the lefties, is such an animating force in what they do. And it's become more apparent recently, but it's been there for a long time. Take, for example, these protests that have been happening over the past week or week and a half, where people have gathered armed to the teeth at state capitals in various states around the country, pushing for the relaxation of social distancing measures. And this is definitely grounded, at least in part, in economic need, but it's also a rejection of what they perceive the liberals are telling them to do. Oh, the fancy pants learned folks are telling us we got to stay home. Well, we have freedom, and we're not going to stay home. We are going to stick it to the liberals and have this protest here at the Ohio State Capitol, and we don't care if a bunch of us get sick because this thing is just like the flu anyway, right? All of this rejection of science and of rationality is about sticking it to lefties. And today, they're even going to die because of it. That's the glaring irony in all of this.
Well, it is an irony, and this is also about the ideology of a large segment of American religious fundamentalists. And I want to make a distinction between those who are true believers in a God world, and those who insist on the literalism of such things as Noah's Ark, is a big favorite, Adam and Eve, and so on. Those literalisms are very dangerous. They really are. They're not just nice tales to tell children. They are, in fact, taken literally and animate a whole host of irrational, magical thinking that is really very, very dangerous. And this is not about belief in a God or the Christian religion or the Jewish religion or Islam or whatever. This is really about something very perverse that I would label a phenomenon that began actually with the Baptist movement in the United States in the early days of the Republic.
Tell us more about that Baptist movement.
Pardon me?
Tell us more about that Baptist movement. Are you saying that this forms the underpinnings of what we now consider to be evangelical Christianity?
I believe so. Yeah, I can't really speak to it. I didn't prepare to talk about that.
Oh, okay. Today.
But
so it piqued my interest.
I raised the issue. It's my fault. I should just say that there was an enormous movement that burned its way through upstate New York and then followed down the Appalachian Trail, and it, in the process of that created the new modern baptism that we hear and see, but also created some other religious oddities, for example, like the Mormon Church. These were things that the Mormon Church is a particularly American institution. Baptism existed in Europe before it came to the United States, but these movements are insisting on a literal interpretation of a translation set that came out of a period when King James was the King of England. And it's not a great translation, number one, that is, it's not literally correct. And number two, it is often taken literally beyond the intent of the people who put it together, because they really were talking about a theology, not a history.
Oh, I see. So misguided from the very get-go.
Well, I think so. Now, a lot of people may disagree or even be offended by what I've said, but I think that's what's the case.
We do have another caller, if you are taking callers right now.
Sure, yeah. Let's take another caller, and then we'll talk about the states that are partially reopening their economy. Caller, you're up. Good morning.
Hey, is that me?
Yeah.
Yes.
Hey, I've been listening to you guys for about 7 years. This is the first time I've had to stop my tractor and actually take out my phone and call you guys. I might have to cut off shortly because my boss might be coming around. But what I wanted to say is I didn't think something like this would happen, this kind of climate degradation-infused situation for 30 or 40 years from now. I didn't think it would come this quickly. There are about 1.7 million additional coronaviruses existing right now. I think neither Trump nor the corrupt and senile Joe Biden has any idea of what to do in a situation like this. I think it's
all... Well, that remains to be seen, doesn't it?
Pardon me?
That remains to be seen. We don't know what he would do.
Well, I don't have much faith in the Democratic Party. Additionally, I think one of Biden's problems is the same thing that infects the rest of the Democratic Party is they are warmongers, and they are not going to end these seven wars that we are currently fighting, which is draining our economy. I think it's almost too late in any event to do anything about climate degradation, and I'm afraid that the next 100 or 200 years is going to be very, very dangerous for the human population. And I work with a lot of Trumpers, but that's my perspective, and that's what I wanted to say.
Okay, well, thanks for the call.
Yeah, right. Sure, you may be correct. And I have to say, this is the first time we've gotten a call from the back of a tractor, so thank you for that. That's pretty great.
Hey.
Thanks very much. Wow. Yeah, the corrupt and senile Joe Biden, would he have any more of a clue as to what to do right now? That I think, though, that it's likely that Joe Biden would at least have the sense to listen to experts around him.
Well, I think that I would guess that that's true. But moreover, there's a tradition, actually, an op-ed piece in today's New York Times. There was a tradition which was actually very conservative, where former presidents would be called in and actually listened to by present presidents. And this is it didn't matter whether they were Democrats or Republicans, and sometimes their advice was even taken. This is not what Trump does. In fact, Trump very loudly disavows any previous Republican or Democratic president and their advice. He doesn't want to hear it.
Yeah, that's very true. That's enough to qualify it as advice to be rejected out of hand. Is it something Obama said or recommended? Well, then I'm going to do the exact opposite.
Yeah, and actually he does that and has hurt a lot of people in that process.
Right. But see, getting back to what I was saying earlier, his supporters love that. They love that he does things specifically to contravene what Obama did before him. They love when he says provocative things that make left-wing heads explode. They love all of this stuff. And it predates Trump, as I was trying to explain. So much of the resistance to what right now, at this moment in time especially, is rational thought that will help preserve your life and the life of your family. The resistance to that sort of rationality is baked into the conservative mindset in the United States. Opposition to climate change is largely tribal. Opposition to redistribution of wealth is largely tribal, even on the part of those people who could use a little more wealth. And opposition to social distancing and the stay-at-home protocols that we're under right now is largely tribal. And I'm going to offer some evidence right now to support that.
Okay.
So, as of right now, there are a handful of states who are already partially reopening their economies in various ways. There's a lot of different ways in which this is manifesting itself, and I don't want to get into that level of detail unless callers are interested, and I will. But those economies right now, those states that are partially reopening their economies are Alaska, Montana, Colorado, Minnesota, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Mississippi, Georgia, and South Carolina. So already right now, there has been at least a partial lifting of social distancing protocols. There are a number of other states whose stay-at-home orders are set to expire at the end of this month. Those states, Idaho, Nevada, Arizona, Texas, Alabama, Florida, and Maine. So taken together, all of these states that are either already opening their economies or about to, they are concentrated in the old Confederacy and in the Mountain West. Their congressional representation in state houses are overwhelmingly Republican. Their political positioning is overwhelmingly conservative. These are the people howling right now to be able to go out and get a haircut.
Yeah, I need a haircut. Hey, listen, yeah. I could do it with a beard cut.
Yeah, you know, I could use one too. We all could use a freaking haircut right now, okay? But we all realize, those of us who are thinking rationally, realize that to do so simply poses too great a risk, right? So to all those out there who really would like to get a haircut but know that they can't, I would say embrace your scruffiness right now. Embrace your coronavirus beard or whatever hair is growing on whatever part of your body right now that you can't have professionally groomed. I would say, you know, embrace that, celebrate it, because it's going to be with you for the at least the near future.
Yeah, but it probably will turn into a style.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting to me that the very people who are clamoring right now to get a haircut are the very same people who fought against things like universal health care, that have fought against things like taxing the rich, who are suffering the most right now and will suffer the most if the social distancing guidelines are removed. And once again, those allegiances are largely tribal in orientation, proving by contention that sticking it to the libs is at least as important as any other consideration in the conservative
side. And I want to add something to that. I think there is because of the class structure of the United States and because of the failure of the educational system to reach everybody effectively, there is a real sense of deprivation, and it's real. It's real deprivation that is part of what really amplifies and animates this anger and this reactionary sentiment. I don't like the word conservative in this context, because there are some very, very smart conservatives. I think rather what it is it's reactionary. It's a response to the perceived la-di-da quality of the smarty pantses who go to universities, get good jobs, do very well, or could do very well, or are part of the creative class. And those people are perceived by these people at the bottom as really advantaged and snooty and dissing them, and there's a real sense of deprivation there.
Indeed. Yeah, I think you're right about that.
We do have a caller taking more callers.
Sure.
Yeah, well, let's go to the caller in just a second. I want to put a cap on what Joe just said. You know, you're talking about this feeling of poor white folks, let's speak it as it is here, feeling aggrieved and judged by who, you know, these effete lefty know-it-alls from the coast, right? So how does the Republican Party, how have they, over the course of decades now, managed to convince those people to keep voting against their own self-interest? And the answer is they have exploited white identity and racial grievance.
That's very true, and that's a very key aspect of this.
Yes. Let's go to the phones. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Linda. I wanted to say that I wanted to go back to the caller before who was talking about Trump and Biden, and I wanted to say you answered that we don't know what Biden would do, but we do. We're watching what Biden would do, which is basically nothing, while, you know, the disparities between, you know, people of color and white people dying goes on, and all sorts of things that he could try to provide leadership on if he actually had the ability to provide leadership. But I think you miss that a lot of people see Biden as just part of the problem that came to erupt now. You know, and if you look at the Democratic Party and you listen to even AOC within that party, what they have been getting us out of these huge money deals are not for the people. They're not for regular people. They're not hitting regular people. They're almost nothing. That $1,200 would last some families all of 1 week for, you know, the food and stuff that they need to handle.
I might buy a bigger TV.
So I just want to say, I think we know what Biden would do, and there's nothing impressive about it. And the Democratic agenda would probably have been better. I agree with you. Nobody could be worse than Trump, and would probably have been more professional in handling this from the start. But their answers are the same neoliberal answers that want to give all our money to the wealthy. And I think you guys need to face that and realize that lots of people from all sides of the tribes see that and know that and have no interest in a Biden or a Pelosi either. So anyway, I'll let you chew on that. Thank you.
Certainly.
Thanks for the call. You know, this is an interesting problem, really. I'm not going to argue about what Biden would or would not do. I don't know, and I don't know who his advisors would be, and I don't know that I have a great love for the current Democratic Party, quite the contrary. But I do know that Trump is a fascist, and that if he's left in power, the consequences will be incredibly severe. And I really am willing to go with a weak president, even whatever, to get rid of Trump, to gamble on the fact that the consensus of the Democratic Party, while not my cup of tea, will certainly not be fascism in the same way that is clear with Trump.
Yeah, that's, I agree with you, Joe, but I agree in a qualified way and in a very, very reluctant way. I think the caller is absolutely correct in all that she says. The choice that we're faced with here is maddening, and it's sort of a distilled and focused and magnified version of the same choice that leftists have been forced to make in this country. Not forced to make, but been confronted with in this country for many years. And that is, we have the choice of two very, very unsatisfactory options in terms of national leadership. And in this time around, it's especially egregious, because now we're being asked, well, which credibly accused sexual predator would you like to vote for president? It is an absolutely maddening situation. Joe Biden is so far from the kind of figure we need right now to lead this country, not only out of the current disaster, but to try and set it on a sustainable footing to preserve the future of the ecosystem for our children and grandchildren, as a previous caller said. So the choice this time around is even more maddening than it usually is. And I can only say that choice has to be made by each voter on the basis of their own values and how they apply to the world.
Well, I'm less liberal, as it were, in this little L liberal way, than you are on this question. I do not think Biden's administration will be as harmful or as fascistic as what is there right now with Trump. He has demonstrated not only a fascist mindset, but a stupid mindset, and he is a very dangerous man who is embarking on a really weird ego trip, and that has got to end. It's got to end.
Yeah, it's a revolting predicament.
We have Harry on the line if you're ready to take more callers.
Yeah,
let's take a call. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen, and thank you for taking my call. The first topic I'd like to talk about is you were talking about reopening the states. I think what's going on here is one-upmanship. When Washington, Oregon, and California announced that they were going to reopen their economies with the a get together and how to do it. The Republican states did not like the idea that these three Western states were going to open before them. So that's why Georgia jumped in and says, well, we're going to reopen our economy now. The bad thing about Georgia is their death rates and infection rates are still going up. It's not going down like us, you know. So it's like one-upmanship. They're trying to say, look, the Republican states opened before the Democratic states did. And your opinion
on that? Yeah, we own the lids. Yeah, we own the lids. We lost a few extra thousand people, but that's all right. We stuck it to the lids.
Uh-huh.
Now, Abe.
It's true, Joe. This is true. My analysis of the conservative psyche, even though I have no psychological education, is absolutely true.
Okay. This is not an argument I want to have now.
Okay.
Hey, thank you for the call.
Okay, well, my next question is to
sure, go ahead.
Joe. I have another question for Joe.
Yes?
Okay, the question I have for you is it's called Living Memory. There was a radio program on NPR about the 1918 flu epidemic, and that's like for living memory. But there was actually a guy who was 107 years old, and they interviewed him and says, "Do you remember the flu epidemic?" And he says, "Yes, I did, because I was 5 years old, and there was a kid across the street that I used to play with. All of a sudden, he disappeared. We didn't know what happened. He died of the flu." And he also mentioned saying that houses actually had signs on them that said big signs on them that said quarantined.
But I was surprised
that, you know, there's still people that are still alive. Remember, and the question I have for you, Joe, is you were about 5 years old when World War II ended. Do you remember when you were 5 years old, World War II? I mean,
well, I remember the end of the war. I do actually remember it quite well. I was living in Brooklyn at the time, and I remember everybody going out into the street with whatever noisemakers they could have, twice, at first for the defeat of Germany and then for the defeat of Japan. So it was a very important thing. And I also remember the inherent propaganda against the Nazis. For example, whenever we built a fire, a campfire or a fire in a fireplace, if there was a box in the fire that burst into flames, we would all chant, "Hitler's house is burning down."
Oh, okay. And also, when you were about a teenager, the polio vaccine showed up. Do you remember taking the polio vaccine in the early 50s?
Do you really want me to count these little tales? I mean, the first time I took polio vaccine, in fact, I was living in New York. I was going to Columbia University. There was a card table set up by the New York health authorities with these sugar cubes with the living or dead virus. And without knowing what the hell I was doing, okay, here's a way to fight polio. And I picked up a sugar cube and sucked it down.
Oh, okay. Okay, that's all I have. Thank you very much.
I also remember at one point being in a school situation with a lot of kids who had been physically damaged by polio. Many of them just recently out of iron lungs and stuff. So on the more important and the more serious side. That was very much a part of our lives. I also remember my parents not wanting me to go to the public swimming pool because of the possibility of catching polio.
Okay. Oh, well, thank you for your memories.
Such as they are.
Hey, thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
We do have one more if you're taking them.
Sure, let's take it.
Yeah, let's keep going with the phone. It's getting weird and interesting. Both at the same time.
Caller, you on the line?
Good morning.
Yes. Yes.
Good morning.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Hi. Abe and Joe, this is Barry, and I appreciate what you've been talking about our fellow in office, being straightforward about him, and then the other person that got the election, a Democrat. Nancy Pelosi did well as a Democrat, but but this guy is, anyway, he shouldn't be in there. But there's no one that can force me to vote for someone. Why don't?
Well, I don't think anyone's trying to force you to vote for anyone, man. That's free will. You can vote for whomever.
Oh yeah. I mean, entrap me, sort of. Then the wrong word. Entrap me to vote for someone. No, I'm not going to. What's important is Senator Sanders was placed out of office. There should be really a third party.
Let me talk a little bit about third parties. I don't think a third party inherently is wrong or bad. I think in order to build an effective third party movement in the United States, you almost have to emulate what happened in 1856. You have to work at state levels and at local levels to build a powerful movement before you can even begin to consider a real change in the national politics. And that is actually historically what happened. Any other attempts that have been made, the Independent Progressive Party in 1948, or even the Bull Moose Party of the Republicans with Teddy Roosevelt, they didn't work because they did not have that grassroots support.
Okay, now you're talking about political parties. I'm talking about people. This guy, Senator Sanders, should be in there. Much more than this other guy that supposedly defeated him. So I would write him in. Okay?
Okay. Okay, my personal fear is that so many people are so disillusioned, not wrongly at all, by the way, by the inability to break through with a progressive candidate on the national level, that they'll either sit on their hands and not vote, or will ironically take a protest vote for someone like Trump. And I think that's all very weird and dangerous, because this is real-world politics.
Okay, yeah, but to vote for the right person, that's what's important for me. Okay?
Okay, sure.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you for the call. Appreciate it, thank you. That's, again, I think that's a decision that every voter has to make. Everybody's got to bring their values to play and make the choice that they can live with. All I would say to people who are struggling with this choice, well, I'd say a couple of things. One, I'm struggling with this choice too. But I think it requires a very careful weighing of the consequences. And you may need to be prepared to accept a set of consequences that are less than satisfactory to you, but that are not disastrous for the rest of the country and the world. It stinks.
Amen
it
to that.
It stinks. Any way you slice it, it stinks.
Well, this, and also what this epidemic and this situation with Trump is actually ripping off the facade of the so-called normal politics in America. And in a way, that's very good, because it's really, I think it's really clear now that the Democratic Party is not the party of progressive effort. It is the party of a certain element of the establishment. The Republican Party is no longer the Republican Party at all. It's the Trump Party, and they've gone wild and insane and dangerous. So for me personally, I don't think there's a choice. It's a hold your nose and do it thing.
Right. Yeah.
We do have.
It stinks.
We do have Jim on the line. If you're still taking callers.
Yeah,
sure. Let's take Jim, and then I want to talk a little bit about the science of testing and what needs to happen before we can stop or before we can lift social distancing. Good morning, caller.
Hey, hi. I live in Yamhill County, and we had an article in the local paper called about post-truth. It's past lies, you know. So this is like Trump's ideology or his own thoughts are more important than reality. And so Trump lies, you know, people lie to get you accept that as truth, but Trump lies to show that he can get away with it, that he's powerful enough to get away with it. And so this post-truth is to show his dominance. You know, he is the president. and you're not, is like he says. And
well, I agree. It's a sick kind of machismo, for sure.
Yeah. And so in this article I was reading on the, or it was in the local paper from the conversation.com/US, but this article is saying that post-truth foreshadows pre-fascism, an electoral dictatorship.
I think that's the truth.
Yeah, so the elections really don't change things, you know. And
well,
so
I don't think elections do or don't change things. I think that situations, politics, the details of legislation, and all kinds of things that are very complex change things. And the ability to know exactly what those changes will produce is also a very difficult to know. However, from my point of view, I just want to say this clearly. It could be a horse running. I would vote for that horse rather than for Trump, because I know what Trump is, and I know where his mind is set to go, and I know that his base is fundamentally in a fascist orientation, and I have seen historically what fascism does.
Yeah. Well, another point you were talking about, the right wing, you know, we have a county commissioner election down here in Yamhill County, and the local gun group, or the statewide gun group, is running a candidate, and we already got a commissioner. It's part of the Oregon Firearm Federation, OFF, you know, and so they're trying to take over the local county commissioner's race here. So it's like these people you said were marching in Salem with guns. Well, yeah, it's part of this Oregon Firearms Federation. So it'll be interesting to see if what happens if our local government gets taken over by two commissioners that belong to this gun group, you know, and their Second Amendment rights and their quote unquote freedoms are more important than other parts of government.
That was a joke. Please.
Hey, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. We've had some good calls this morning. Some very astute questions, I think. Well, one thing I think it's important we touch on before the end of the show today is, you know, just what we mean when we talk about easing social distancing restrictions and starting to phase people back into their occupations in parts of the economy that are shuttered right now. And really, it revolves entirely around testing. And this is a subject that you just can't get away from. And when we're talking about testing for COVID-19, there's two broad types of testing that you have to bear in mind. The first is the test for the presence of the virus itself in the body. So this is if someone is either experiencing symptoms and believes that they may be infected with COVID-19. And secondly, those who may have been exposed are not showing symptoms, but nevertheless might have the virus and might be able to transmit it. So that's the first kind of test. The second kind of test, which might even be more important in terms of lifting social distancing, is something called a serology test or an antibody test. This tells doctors whether or not a person has been exposed to the virus and developed antibodies against it. Now, this is important for a number of reasons, which is that with many viruses, being exposed to a virus and surviving it means that your body is afforded a degree of immunity against reinfection. In some cases, this degree of immunity is total or close to total. With other viruses, it's not. The evidence right now is mixed as to whether or not previous exposure to the novel coronavirus will guarantee you immunity going forward. There is some evidence to suggest that it does offer immunity. We really don't know the extent of that immunity or how to frame that in percentage terms. So those are the two kinds of tests. Both of them have to be brought into play on a much larger scale than we have now in order to reopen parts of the economy. And here's why. What you do, and what we are doing here in the Western states, a good example, is we have stay-at-home orders in place. People are encouraged to stay home whenever possible and only to go out into public to meet their basic needs. And what this is doing is having an effect in a couple of ways. It's the number of new cases is dropping daily in the Western states, and the number of deaths is dropping daily in the Western states. So what we have to do in order to reopen the economy is we need to see the number of new cases drop close to zero, the number of deaths drop close to zero, and then we can start slowly opening up parts of the economy that are shuttered. And here's where the tests come into play. What we need to do is be able to quickly identify new cases of COVID-19. We need to test for them, verify them, isolate the people who are symptomatic, and quickly track and test any people that may have come into contact with that person. This is called contact tracing. You've probably heard that term tossed around in the media quite a bit. And that requires testing capacity of both types of tests that I talked about. And until we have the capacity to do that at a large scale, we can't begin to lift social distancing protocols. We have to be able to quickly identify new cases and quickly isolate and track possible contacts. All that has to be in place before we go forward.
And it's none, not, it's
none
not.
Of that is in place. Yeah, none of that is in place in the states that are looking to reopen their economies.
Well, in fact, you know, Trump, not only he's changed his mind a few times, a dozen times, but essentially, initially, he was against any kind of testing, if you remember. And he argued, bizarrely, that the whole thing would disappear in warm weather.
Yeah, yeah. Or, you know, if you drink some Clorox, it'll go.
Well, only if you drink enough Clorox. Yeah.
Or if you take, you know, ultraviolet light into your body.
Yeah, yeah. How would you? Never mind.
I don't know. Maybe he's own stock in, you know, tanning beds, and he's trying to encourage people to go.
Oh,
you know.
He's certainly an opportunist, but that's such a small market.
So, yeah, this is what we're looking at. That is the task in front of us as a society, to get those capabilities, that capacity into place before we can start approaching something like what life used to be.
No, I agree. I'm thinking that maybe next week, I don't know what will be coming up next week, but maybe I should spend a little time talking about the epidemic of what is called Spanish flu, the true history of it and how it went down. Because there's a lot of misunderstanding of it, and it's used as a bellwether for what we're doing now. And this is an important understanding, and it's not what you think. I just to begin with a little teaser. The whole thing, as far as we can tell, started in army camps, training camps for soldiers going over to World War I in the United States.
I think that'd be fascinating. I imagine there's a lot of lessons to be drawn to apply to
this. Crowding together is always a bad idea.
Yes, indeed. So, to sum up today's show, if you can get your eyeballs on a copy of Fintan O'Toole's recent op-ed column in the Irish Times, please do so. It's well worth your time. Secondly, if you're feeling the pinch and the itch to get outside and mingle with people, don't. It's not time yet. And thirdly, those states that are looking to reopen their economies, in my humble opinion, are doing so prematurely. And I think it's quite likely that you will see a resurgence of new COVID-19 cases in those areas.
Yeah, and I can see that could very well happen. There's so much we don't know about this particular virus, by the way. And all of this is almost speculative. But we do know that the isolating each other is a wise move. That's the one thing we are absolutely certain of. The other thing is the two kinds of testing make sense, even if they're less than perfect. And this is all based on a bias for a scientific methodology.
Yeah, indeed. Before we go, Joe, we got a message on the Facebook page from Shelley who says, I remember the sugar cubes.
Oh, good, I guess.
So you're not alone. We got people out there who remember taking
I know I was not alone. I think half of New York State, city, took them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they put this out in every neighborhood. I was in the Lower East Side. I remember walking along Avenue B, and there was the opportunity to take this thing, and boom, I did it.
And there it is.
So I'm still here.
And one more thing I want to toss into the mix here, just to get people thinking about it, is Germany, whose response to COVID-19 has been, will probably be a textbook example of the right things to do, the right way to go about it. They have begun to reopen their economy in small ways, and they have seen an uptick in new cases, even though they've been very careful and deliberate about it. There's really not enough data yet to say how much those two things are correlated, but the early statistics suggest that maybe Germany might want to slow down in terms of reopening the economy.
No, this thing is going to last a long time, and it's going to be very difficult, and it's going to be very shattering for the economy. It also is a very important thing to make, to use as an example of what would happen if we had a national health plan. We would be in much better shape.
Oh, it's absolutely true, especially if we had health care that was not coupled to employment, right?
We've seen
literally millions of people lose their jobs and file for unemployment, and presumably among them are a lot of people who have now lost their health coverage as a result. It's a dire situation that is only being exacerbated by this pandemic.
Yep. I know it's not profound to say yep, but yep.
I'll echo your yep. I think I'm starting to hear music in the background there. I imagine it's about time for us to sign off.
Yeah, and I want to thank people for listening in this less than ideal situation. I want to urge people to stay tuned to KBOO. Whatever else is going on, it's telling you the truth. So stay tuned, and it's got good music as well.
All right. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll be back with you next week.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Tune in to KBOO on Wednesday, April 29th from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. for the